Welcome to this week's Greg Hughes podcast. After 30 years of unwavering service, Timmy Boyle has stepped down as officer in charge of the Bunbeg Coast Guard. From the early days of 1996, when he helped drive the community fundraising that put the first rescue team on the water, to leading countless operations alongside Malin Head and Rescue 118, Timmy's influence is woven into the very fabric of maritime safety in our region. He's been there for the moments of profound relief, like pulling a young kayaker off a rock just as the tide turned, and he's stood with families during the difficult recoveries that bring a different kind of peace. Today he joins us to reflect on three decades of service. I'm delighted to welcome into our studio today's guests for the podcast. It's Timmy Boyle, who recently retired after 30 years of service with the Bunbeg Coast Guard. Good morning to you, Timmy. How are you getting on?
Morning, Greg. Yeah, going good.
Thanks so much for joining us. How is life treating you?
Life's treating us good.
Yeah, that's very good. So you only this year, this month, in fact, as we record this, stepped down as officer in charge of the Bunbeg Coast Guard. How did you become involved in the operation?
That was in 1996. Just a couple of people, a couple of local lads got together. We had a couple of tragedies along the coast at that time. And a couple of lads got together and decided to arrange a meeting to try and get... Originally, we started off as a community rescue service. And then the Coast Guard actually took us over then in 1998. We'd done a lot of fundraising and from 96 to that time.
So in its first incarnation, is that when it was the St. Columb, Kilcliff and Coastal Search?
Exactly, yes. Okay. Yeah.
So when you got together to meet, what were you looking at as an example of what you guys could do?
I suppose the first thing we'd done was we started looking at what was needed and what was lacking. Now, we always had the RNLI in Arranmore. They've been there for many, many years. But we needed something, a quick response, sort of for inshore kind of thing, you know, sort of close to the shore. So we decided at that time that we needed to get a boat and to get a crew trained up, you know, for rescue like that.
I often think that if I were at those meetings, I would go, right, lads, this is a great idea, but I didn't think about getting the boat and I didn't think about the training and I didn't think about the gear. So maybe, you know, we'll meet again in a year or two. Like, it does take people with, you know, real planning and real drive to get this off the ground from those initial meetings.
Yeah, which is, I think what stood for us, that we had the community behind us. There's a fantastic community in between Bingclan, Ely, Gwydor and the Rosses. There's absolutely fantastic community there. We collected an awful lot of money very, very quickly. From that initial meeting, we travelled to the UK. There was a show on in the UK in Wembley at the time, boat show. We travelled there and we secured a boat. We bought a new boat at that stage.
And what was it felt was needed in terms of equipment? So you had identified the fact that there was a particular space that you needed the gear to be able to respond effectively to. In terms of the proximity to the shore, what size of a boat, how easily it would be launched, etc.
Well, we all had some experience in the water at that stage. You know, we were all sort of, I wouldn't call us mariners or such, but we had a lot of the lads, there was a lot of fishermen involved in that.
So the experience was there, the knowledge was there.
The knowledge was there, exactly, yeah. The knowledge was there. So we went across, myself and another lad went across, and we looked at what was available. And we picked out a boat, which was an ideal boat at the time. We picked out it was a Tornado. We arranged for a deposit, we paid for the boat. I think we had the boat. I think the boat came around about June. And then we started training. At that time, we went as far as Bundoran. We got the lads of the RNLI in Bundoran, a couple of those lads came down and trained us in rescue procedures and stuff like that. And went on from there.
Yeah. And what was determined the sort of amount of crew you would need. So, you know, obviously you're on call, the same small group of people potentially couldn't be on call all the time. So was there a sort of a critical mass of people it was decided was needed to give the appropriate cover?
I think at that time we just took anybody that we could get at that time. I know there was six of us trained on the boat originally. The boat, I think the boat kind of, it was a 5.8 metre boat. It had seats for four people. And then we had different rescue equipment. We organised to get first aid courses done. All that sort of thing. Defibs weren't a thing at that back in those days. But the first aid and the CPR and everything like that, we done all that.
Mm. And I mean, this might seem obvious to someone like you who's been at this for so long, but then how do you make sure that you're an addition and not a hindrance, i.e. in terms of coordination, who's responding to what, when does another agency kick in? Did that all have to be established at that time to make sure everything went as smoothly as possible and the right people reacted at the right time?
Yeah, I think what happens is that if there is a tragedy or something goes on, that everything's thrown at it, for want of a better word. Yeah. You know, sort of, we would get tasks, Dorna Lyon Aran Mhór would get tasks, probably the Rescue 118 would get tasks at that time, the Gardaí, Civil Defence, you know.
It's just really throw every resource
just
at it.
Whatever resource are available. And whoever gets the casualty first, that's the bonus kind of thing.
And we'll pick up that in a moment, but I mean, obviously in the community there was conversations about how we need something that can respond quicker, and this would have been off the back of losses and tragedies and near misses in the community, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Talking about specifics, I can't remember now, going back to those days what it was, but there was a lot of fishing boats lost. Skiffold being one, down through the years, and there's only so much searching one boat can do, or one group of people can do. Mm. So what you were adding to the service, and you were extending the search area and everything like that all the time.
Yeah, and as you say, often adding to whatever can be thrown at a situation, and often would be the first there. And as superb as the other. Elements of the rescue services are, you know, there's going to be knowledge that you guys bring to it because of your local knowledge, and given the fact that you were seafarers, many of you.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, there's places along the coast where, call it debris for want of a better word, gathers, and you'd always get, it's a place, God forbid, if you are looking for a body, it's a place that a body could get washed up. You know, so you get to know the local areas where stuff gathers, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's invaluable local knowledge. Yeah. Also, too, at that time, because, you know, I have a boat, right, and it has to be dead calm before I go out, right? Just to, you know, because then it's not leisure crafting. Yeah. Not dead calm, but you know what I mean. But when you're setting it up, yous are preparing really to have to head out in the worst of weather. And I'm thinking too of maybe, you know, partners and family and how much of a conversation you have with them, because you're saying, right, we're setting something up here and it's a very worthy cause and for all the right reasons. But when that pager goes off or when that call comes, we're going to be heading out when any right-minded person would be heading in sometimes.
Yeah, I always remember, you know, when the Coast Guard goes over first, we were asked a question, what did we see as a successful mission or a successful rescue or whatever word you want to put on it? And everybody answered, oh, we get the casualty or whatever. And he says, no, the successful mission is the crew coming back safe. Mm. And that's first and foremost all the time. And that's what's always been, this past 30 years, that's what's been in the front of my mind.
It's kind of interesting. And it really is a logical approach, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Because you don't want tragedy on top of tragedy. No. So you can only do what you feel your training and your experience and your equipment can allow you to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Obviously, after the establishment of St. Columbkilcliffe and Coastal Search, how soon after, I mean, is there a start point, and how soon after that did you get the call, the first call, for an example? Is that easy to recall?
I think the first call we got was to a boat that had broken down and was drifting. definitely onto the shore. We four of us went out and we tied on and towed that boat back to shore. That was the first. That was a very, very first one.
And it might seem like a handy start, but
it
I'm
was.
Not. Okay, but, you know, without you guys there to get the rope on and to get it back to shore, you know, yeah. That's a preventative one. And just give us the timeline then. You established St. Columbkill's Cliff and Coastal Search. This was in 96, right? Mm-hmm. And continued to add on. You talked about getting new equipment and seeing what else you could do. At what point then did you come under the governance of the Irish Coast Guard?
The Coast Guard, I think we started interviews in 97, probably the latter end of 97. Yeah. And then the Coast Guard actually took us over in 98.
Okay, and what was the advantage of that for you, or why did that happening? Was there a sort of a rationalisation of things at that time? Or?
At that time, being a community rescue service, we'd get, you know, we'd know there was a tragedy going on or something, and we'd sort of self-tasking, for
lack
of a better word.
Yeah.
Whereas as soon as the Coast Guard took over then, we were sort of, we had rules and regulations to go by. We were tasked by Malahide Radio, you know, if there's anything going on.
And was
tasked.
That seen as a big deal at that time? In other words, that, you know, you have built this thing up, you've proven the need for it, you've proven what you're capable of, and now you're being sort of brought into the official, you know, emergency response.
Oh, absolutely. The first thing we started off as a search team first with the Coast Guard, because we were a search team. Then that developed on to, I can't remember if I had this right or not, but we developed on to a cliff rescue team. And then they actually took over the boat. And we were well trained for what we were doing at the time. But as soon as the Coast Guard took over, then the training took a massive leap. You know, we'd done sea survival courses, VHF radio courses. And whole, you know, it expanded everything, and everything became very, very official.
Mm. Do you remember, or is it clear in your mind, when I suppose it became a recovery rather than a rescue? Because I don't know if all the training in the world can necessarily prepare you for that, Timmy.
No, it doesn't. I think the way that we dealt with a lot of the time, from me personally, we could be out on a recovery, and I could meet people the following day, and they would say to you, "Oh, there was an awful tragedy yesterday," and you say, "Oh, what happened yesterday?" Mm. You know, you seem. Well, my way of dealing with it, I was able to sort of put it to the one side and kind of put it at the back of my mind and kind of forget about it. Not that you'd ever forget about it.
No, but you know, would compartmentalise,
yes,
and say,
yeah,
I can deal with that another time.
Yeah.
And that worked for you, because
it worked for me, yes. Yeah,
sometimes,
yeah,
you know, we're advised to deal with things rather than, but I suspect in the way you've described that you were continuing to deal with it in your own way, just not publicly.
Just not publicly, yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, you become very used to it, sort of thing.
Mm.
You know, because along with the recoveries, I'm also involved with Shephaven, search and recovery, which they do underwater recovery and stuff like that. And we've had a lot of tragedies with Shephaven as well.
Yeah, it's awful. Yeah. But I mean, obviously, too, in your mind is those successes. And does anything spring to mind about those, maybe even what seemed like a lost cause that turned out positively for you?
There's quite a few cases. There's one case that has always stuck in my mind. Sort of, it wasn't one of those that you could forget easily. There was one in particular where a group of students, can't remember what the occasion was, but it was kind of in the summer, and they had a party on, and they decided to go jumping off the rocks, and one of the lads, he jumped at just the wrong time, and the waves hit him and shoved him deep into a crevice. That was a tragedy. That's a tragedy, and that's a tragedy that always stuck with me, sort of thing, because I had a young family myself.
Yeah, and that was the it was inescapable, because you could say, well, that could be me, kids just out having a bit of fun,
absolutely,
and just a wave at a certain time.
Yeah, just they jumped at the wrong time, and just a wave hit him, and that, you know, that was it, sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
So when you were launched, and I'm kind of thinking, you know, rough seas, maybe at night. I presume you just launched at night as
we do,
well.
Yes. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What's going through your head? Because, I mean, I know the training is there and you can lean on that, but the one thing we all need to learn, if we don't know it already, is the water's the boss.
Oh, absolutely, no question.
The weather's the boss.
Absolutely.
We're just pawns, really.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So, I mean, you could be heading out. Like, how far out could you potentially head out?
We would probably, most of our work would be sort of within the islands or you know, probably 3 miles.
Which is
3 miles.
On a bad night, you're still out deep, not a bad day.
Yeah. I suppose the most recent one was we had a tragedy in just off the coast in Bunbeg there in Marigallen, where a kayaker had lost his life. We were tasked there in the middle of the night. I think it was 1 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. We were tasked originally. You know, it had been going on sort of for a while, sort of for a couple of hours before that, but you know, when this is right, we need to go out and see what's going on here. That was a bad night, a rough night.
Yeah.
Wet, windy.
And you know, you're lucky to get home yourself.
Well, it's not something we don't really think about that,
yeah,
really.
See, that's what I've asked a couple of questions along those lines, and I know you don't.
Yeah.
And that's what, for people listening, might seem hard to believe, but It's not that you don't care. It's not carelessness.
Not at all.
It's drilled into you that you expect to. You've prepared to get home.
Yeah.
And also, too, the one thing that is, when I've interviewed people, and sadly I've interviewed lots of people in very difficult situations, be it on land or sea, in mountains, in valleys, is the gratefulness they have towards the emergency services. And often they don't know who they are or they don't know who to thank. But once they are sort of working through their trauma and their loss, what the emergency services do, what you guys do, and I think particularly there's never a guarantee if someone's lost at sea that they come home. How important was it for you to be able to give what is good news in a horrible news situation, that you can return the body of a loved one to their family?
That's always the main reason why you go out there. You go out there to try and bring back, you know, bring back somebody to the family so they can grieve, and there's closure. When somebody's missing and they don't turn up, it's ongoing and ongoing and ongoing. I can only imagine what it's like. You know, you're wondering, you know, did they make it onto an island? Did they, you know, did they get banged in the head? You know, did they not know where they are or anything like that? That's always in the mind, you know, but, you know, when somebody does come back, that's it. It's closed.
Yeah, I was chatting to someone recently and a person who had gotten into difficulty was sort of sought refuge in a cave or a cavern or what have you, and hearing helicopters and boats and all spinning around, unable to do anything, such as the vastness of the sea, and thankfully they were recovered. But it just goes to show. On a positive note, in terms of recovery of people, saving people, are there any stories that stick out in your mind, Timmy?
I suppose that the most, well, I say recent, it's a few years ago. One lad, he went out in a kayak from, again, locally in Gwydor.
Mm.
He went out in a kayak and he got washed out. Just got hit by a freak wave and he got washed out. He actually made it to a rock, and he started shouting, and just by luck that people heard him.
Wow.
We went out and got him into the boat, and the relief, you know, the relief from that man that day, you know, it's satisfying. We you know, it's something you do and you don't even think about it. It's only afterwards when you start thinking about it, you know, just that's a job well done.
And how do you keep these things going for so long, Timmy, in terms of, you know, there always has to be a turnover of volunteers. You can never have enough volunteers in training. And how big of a part of it is that? Because, again, talking to, say, for instance, people involved in mountain rescue, and often maybe if it's a May Day and nothing comes of it, all the gear has to be unpacked, right? Often maybe it then has to be washed down and stored away. You know, it's not literally turning up at the mountain or turning up at the seashore and that's the end of it, right? There's an awful lot of stuff, checking equipment and all that type of thing. But also getting people that are so community-minded that they're prepared to sign up for that. Has it been tough or easier than you might expect to keep the crew at the level it's needed?
We've been very, very lucky. We've been very lucky in Bunbeg. We have a great and absolute fantastic group of people. People have come and gone down through the years. Life gets in the way, life takes over, you know, things like that. But we've always had a good core. I think we have 22 of a crew there. And, you know, we always get enough. If you get 10 or 12 people out to say to do a search, or like the boat's normally crewed with four people, four, six people if we're on an extended search. You know, there's always a crew there and there's always a response. Mm-hmm. I've never, down through the years, came to a situation where we couldn't, where we were tasked and we couldn't respond.
Do you have any idea how many you were tasked, how many times you were tasked?
Oh my God, no.
It's just impossible, isn't it? An open-ended bucket.
Yeah.
Obviously, not wishing to attribute blame, but sometimes maybe respect for the water can be learnt the hard way. And it's astonishing, really, even we live in a coastal area. It astonishes me, not maybe as much the new generation, but if you go back a generation or two of inshore fishermen who couldn't swim or didn't swim, never wanted to swim. Yeah. And there's different folklore as to why that was, right? Mm-hmm. But also to just the rest of us on the land. We try, but there's just this misunderstanding of how dangerous not only our seas, but our inland waters are. And unfortunately, every year, there's so many lives lost and so many near misses. But the education doesn't seem to land where it needs to, Timmy.
It doesn't, you know. And, you know, you can go back generations, but even to today, there's a lot of people that can't swim.
Yeah.
And they would not spend a lot of time on the water. You see, you know, we've seen some crazy things down through the years, and I just heard of a case recently where the rescue service took a child in off the Alilo, and the parents, the main concern for them was why were they not going out to recover the Lilo as well? You know what I mean by the Lilo?
The wee
rubber mattress or whatever you
just
call it.
Just didn't get the significance of what just happened.
Just didn't get it.
That flotation device is nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
I mean,
The one thing just in relation to that, and I'm not pointing any fingers at any particular shops or what have you, but coming into the summer or even a spell of good weather, we'll see a proliferation of these adverts for, you know, kayaks or inflatable boats or lilos or what have you. And I've yet to see a life jacket in there or, you know, anything along those lines. You know what I mean? So they're selling this stuff that you can pick up for half nothing, head straight to the beach. The onshore breeze, or there's no breeze, next year it's an offshore breeze. Mm-hmm. But there's no sort of, they don't sell safety gear either. That always, makes me wonder that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is true. It's the law now is, if I have this right, that nobody under 16 can operate a power boat.
Mm.
Anybody in an open boat must wear a life jacket. That's the law. I think the problem we have is that it's who's responsible for
who enforces it. I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Are you going to come across someone who says stick your life jacket on or get that young girl off that jet ski? It's not going to happen. But I mean, obviously, would you like to see more regulation in terms of sort of boat ownership, jet skis, punts, you know, 18 footers, whatever? Like, I mean, if you look at what you have to do to get behind the wheel of a car or a motorbike or a scooter, well, not scooters as much, you know, there's a lot of hoops to go through. Yet you can just buy something off Dundeal and head out to sea, and you don't even know if the engine's going to get you back.
That's right, yeah, and it happens regular. You can buy the most powerful boat and just sit into it in a way, and there's nothing to stop you. You know, that's definitely, I think we need regulation in that. Something, maybe not to the extent of what we do in the driving, but that, you know, you'd learn, so if you're doing a couple of courses, say, how to read the water, how to know when the tide's coming and when the tide's going. A lot of people wouldn't even know when it's going to be high tide or low tide. You know, it just doesn't enter the equation, kind of thing. And yet they're going out in a boat.
Yeah.
And
I think one of the most mechanical things, even in 2026, that's complicated, unreliable, and hard to get anyone to work on is an outboard engine.
Well,
I think anyone who has one in existing would know what I'm on about, right?
Well, we do that for a living, so.
Do you? All right, okay, I'll keep your number, good man. But do you know, like, you know, winterizing the engine or making sure it's, you know, even people that have been around a bit and should know better, because once that engine dies, or once you, you know, lose contact with the shore, depending on what vehicle you're in, you can move really quite quickly in the sea. You are completely at its. So in terms of, you know, even obligatory communications devices with you, or what, you know.
Absolutely. You're at the mercy. If you break down in the water, you're at the mercy of the sea or the wind, as the case may be, and that's not always favourable.
Okay. Do you remember the time there was a risk to us losing Malin Head? How big a deal was that for you guys at that time?
That was
a big campaign.
That was a big campaign, yeah. And that would have been a serious mistake. A lot of the lads in Malin, they'd be familiar with, you know, just experience they get used to, you know, who's responding, how we would respond, how, say, the team in Killybegs would respond, what we have and everything like that. Whereas if you're dealing with somebody from Dublin, they're... Or anywhere, they're just dealing with imagination would be the wrong word to use.
But it's just they don't have the knowledge.
Exactly.
Do they?
Yeah.
I mean, having that. I just remember at the time, and it was people I have a great deal of respect for, and it was like, if we go through with this, people are going to lose their lives.
There's absolutely,
doubt about that.
Yeah.
I know you were involved in the search operation for the 116 helicopter. I mean, that was an awful tragedy. But did it feel particularly personal for you guys, as you were all part of the one team, so to speak?
I think it's always personal, no matter when you go out. You know, the rescue 116, what we were looking for at that stage, because they did find some debris getting washed up. We even washed up as far as far north as Tory, bits and pieces. So that's why the search was a massive, massive search that time. And we were all hoping that we'd find something, but unfortunately we didn't.
But still, you searched until there was no...
We searched, yeah.
Until there was no time to search.
The thing with the Coast Guard, we have a 21-day, they'll do a 21-day search. And then, depending on how that goes,
because there's lots of variables, and this is all based on knowledge.
Absolutely,
before. What kind of role then? What was your involvement in that? You would be assisting hikers on Errigal. Is that through Sheephaven? Is it all?
No. A couple of times, we had a couple of times that we got called to assist. Say somebody got injured on Errigal.
All right, okay.
That we would go up and bring them down.
How did you end up with that new sea, guys?
well, we do a lot of searching, as we do a lot of land searching as well.
Yeah,
you know, for missing person on land, and there's no restriction there.
Yeah.
I suppose you have the knowledge. We have the equipment, and we could get there a lot quicker probably than the actual mountain rescue.
Do you think the likes of your organisation, even the RNLI, the Coast Guard, in terms of funding and support, because they are an emergency service, but you would see the ambulance, the fire service, the Gardaí, all very well resourced and all that type of stuff. But in terms of our fourth emergency service, those that head to the sea or up the mountains, mm-hmm. or wherever they're tasked, they'll go wherever needs to go. It's all voluntary. It's all community organised and often fundraised for. Is that what makes it special? Or do you believe maybe that fourth emergency services should be brought into the wider family?
I think there's been a lot of discussions about that down through the years. As volunteers in the Coast Guard, we'll always say, you know, it was never about money for us.
No, of course,
you know,
not. Yeah.
Like the equipment that we have now, we have really top class equipment. You know, when I think of how we started first, back in the day, you know, but the equipment that we have now, we have jeeps, we have four wheel drives, we have top class boats, we have very, very good equipment. Now, I'm sure if you were talking to somebody else, they might say, no, we don't, you know, but I can speak personally. I think we have top-class gear now. Even the equipment that we have, that we wear, the clothes we wear, you know, it's all really good stuff. You know.
Right. So you'd be keeping the status quo, leave it as it is, or?
I think it's good the way it is.
I think so. I think sometimes that little bit of independence can work as well. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that it's the volunteerism that makes it so special.
Yeah, I think so. What do you do to relax?
I do a lot of hiking.
Yeah.
Hiking, walking, scuba diving, snorkeling.
Scuba diving, yeah, love it. Yeah, I'd love to try that one time.
Yeah, well. You missed opportunities. You haven't had a try a dive there a couple of weeks ago.
I'm sure there'll be another one in the future.
There will be one next year again. So,
what is it about snorkeling? What do you see? I know this might sound stupid, right? Not snorkeling, sorry. Snorkeling's a bit easier, but scuba diving, is it just around the coast? Do you go wreck diving or what?
Personally, I was never keen on wreck diving because that's all it is. It's a wreck. I'd rather just go along the coast or wherever we're diving and see what's down there. It's just very relaxing. It's hard to describe. It's hard to explain it without.
Yeah,
without
it is, but that's the explanation. It's just a switch off.
Yeah.
It's all integrated and tied to the sea with you, though, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's not so much even the. But say for like I said, I'm part of Sheephaven. Even with Sheephaven, it's the camaraderie that's in the club and the social aspect of it. You know, we meet, like we still meet every Sunday now, even right all year. And I will be, as the summer comes on, we'll do it on a Wednesday as well. But we always have good fun, good laugh, and you know, it's a great release.
Yeah.
You know, from your daily sort of pressures.
Sounds fantastic. So reflecting on, and your decision to step down as officer in charge. Why? Why now?
Well, I had the big 7-0, so I had no choice.
Simple
as that.
This is crazy, isn't it? Because I doubt anyone, I could bring anyone in here, they wouldn't say you were 70.
Yeah, well.
So it's crazy that we would lose you from that position because of some arbitrary number.
Yeah, well, that's the way it
is. But you'd have kept going if it wasn't for these crazy rules.
Yeah. But maybe it's time for somebody else to take over. You know, it's.
But you'll always be involved.
I'm always involved, yeah. I'm always, as I always say, I'm only ever a phone call away. You know.
Reflecting on your career with Bonbeg Coast Guard and all the different organisations you've been involved in, what is the lasting memories for you? Not that they're finished, right? I don't want to write you off.
No, not yet. I mean.
We're speaking in the context of this latest, moving away as officer in charge.
I suppose the fact that the team always came back safe.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what happened. So that's first and foremost. We've had arguments with some lads. Yeah, we need to go out and search that. I said, no, you can't go out. It's not safe. And, you know, just different things like that.
How difficult were those calls that you had to make in relation to that? Just to hold the lads back?
Sometimes it's difficult, but, you have to leave it to say that. Darren and I are always there. They have a big all-weather boat.
Yeah.
So it's not as if you're leaving somebody floundering. There's always the second. So it's just, I was going to say, leave it to professionals. That's the wrong word to use. But
I know what you mean.
What I mean is, they're better equipped for appropriate rougher weather.
I know exactly what you're saying, but I mean, obviously, that goes back to some of the first comments you made. It's about you make sure the crew gets home first.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you did, and you
first
have
and foremost, yeah.
in your entire time
yeah.
in charge, which is it feels like it's odds defying, but it's not an accident. It's been by design.
Hmm. Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have to, when you get a shout, you're not just looking at the. Oh, there's somebody lost, when you go and find them, you have to look at the big picture. And that's, as I said, that's your crew coming back safe. That's correct.
So, I mean, just back briefly before we wrap up, it's getting the message across to, I always find it when I'm talking about water safety, because our activity in the water often is associated with brilliant memories. Is it going fishing with your dad on the rocks or your mum? Or off the pier, or is it getting your first boat and heading out, or is it, running with your mates to jump into a lake? That's fine, but it has to be done without booze, with knowledge of where you're going, with the understanding of the water, with all that type of stuff. I find it difficult sometimes to talk about water safety because it's so joyous and it's such a luxury for us to have these beautiful waterways, but we really need to learn its power and who's boss and to respect it.
Absolutely. That's, you know, there's so much out there, so much leaflets and everything out there. If people would only read it and just stop to think, even if they took the smallest part of it, of those safety messages that are out there, if you're out in the boat, wear a life jacket. Some people buy a life jacket 10 years ago and they're still wearing it today and it's never been serviced. You may as well just wear your jacket, your coat, because that's all it's doing. Yeah, that's all it's doing. Follow the rules. I said life jacket if you're out in a boat, life jacket. Even if you're near the sea at all, you know, if you're going out in the rocks, say fishing for argument's sake, you can be hit by a freak wave. Very, very easy, and you're on the water, and that's it. If you have your life jacket on, close to the water even, you know, that's going to save you, like. You know, it's as simple as that. Those blow-up things, they're fine, keeping on the beach, fine lying on the beach, keep you off the sand. They're not meant for underwater. If you're taking your child out in the water, make sure that you're with them and that you're holding on to that air blanket.
I mean, if you think just about a wind... So 6 mile an hour wind. Well, where's that lie low in 15 minutes or 10 minutes or 5 minutes?
Yeah, because it's like a big sail. It just sits on top of the water.
And as soon as it goes out a bit, the wind gets underneath it.
Absolutely, it's gone.
It's horrible, isn't it, to think. And in terms of boating, do you recommend people keep a radio with them?
Absolutely, they should. They should have a radio with them. If you call the radio, say the emergency channel is 16 on VHF, and you'll get straight through this emergency channel, straight to Malin Head, or any other boat that's in the area will hear that. Mm-hmm. And anybody that's in the water will respond to an emergency. You know, they'll call, yes, we're sort of here, we'll make our way there now. Mm. You know, all that goes on all the time. If you have a radio, all that's going on. Ideally, if you have a radio, you do the VHF course, the radio course. There's plenty of them available, plenty of people doing it.
And you need to give your location as well too, so some way to identify where you are.
And the good thing, a lot of the radios now, they have what they call the DSC, Digital Selective Calling, I think. Once you press that, your position is transmitted right away and Malinhead will know exactly where you are.
Fantastic. And there is advice too, to if you are heading out maybe for an afternoon's fishing or whatever you might be doing, to advise the Coast Guard.
Absolutely. Always tell somebody where you're going, when you can be back. Tell the Coast Guard. There's personal e-perbs now. If you go in the water, it just sets it off.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just personal locator beacon.
And the water activates the beacon.
Well,
listen, Timmy, the work that you've done over the last 30 years and the other people that you work with and all the other people involved in keeping us safe at sea, rescuing us from sea, the searches and all manner of calls that you've had out, it's immeasurable. We could never determine how many lives you've saved or how many families you've kept together because you've been doing it so for long and you can't even count. You don't even know how often you've been out, if you know what I mean. So it really, really is amazing. I think it's amazing. And we owe you a massive debt of gratitude. And as I say, you might be stepping away as officer in charge at Bunbeg Coast Guard, but you're still very much involved and the phone's never off. But again, you know, thanks. I mean, it's astonishing what you people do.
Oh, appreciate it. Thank you. The main thing is, the main thing to remember, I'm only just one person, a team of 20, 22.
But you're the one person here.
Just you.
Okay. Is there anything you want to add before we wrap up, Timmy? Because I suppose, you know, you've worked with a lot of people over the years, and I don't know, you're not heading away. You'll see them soon. But, you know, whilst we do have you here, you know, people in the community, family, I mean, is there anyone that you want to speak to before we wrap up?
I think that every one of the volunteers in there, like, there is a family behind them. And it's not just that one person that's out there, like the whole family is involved, really. So it's a massive thank you to everybody, you know, that gives their time free, you know, and everybody involved in it, not just the Coast Guard, but Ornalai, Mahon Rescue, everybody. It's amazing what people do, you know, and you know, don't even think about it. It's just the pager goes off or you get the phone call. That's it. Throw on your jacket and you're gone. Don't even think about it and that's it.
Second nature.
You know, second nature at this stage, yeah.
But, you just run to it when we others run away from it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Timmy Boyle, who has stepped away after 30 years of service to the Bunbeg Coast Guard, a remarkable contribution that hasn't really finished here. But thank you so much for coming in for a chat. It's been really, really enjoyable and lovely to get a, well, normally I'm chatting to you from like the shoulders up, but also to get an opportunity to talk more about you and what you've contributed. And I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Greg.
What an absolute gentleman. Right, I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the Greg Hughes Podcast. Don't forget, it's available for you every Friday morning from 11 a.m. If you have any comments, recommendations or suggestions, feel free to email our researcher and producer, that is Caroline Orr. Her email address, carolineorr@highlandradio.com. But until we chat again,